Hey guys, this right here is going to be PALS, the Pediatric Advanced Life Support. And the way it's going to go is I'm going to try to keep it in this order. The systematic approach to the pediatric patients, pediatric shock recognition, pediatric management of shock, recognizing respiratory distress, managing respiratory distress, recognizing cardiac arrest, management of cardiac arrest, arrhythmias, recognition of those arrhythmias, and then management of those arrhythmias. I don't remember PALS being this deep, but again, it's been almost 2 years since I've taken PALS, but it seems like it's a lot more in depth than just your normal ACLS. So this material is coming straight from the book for the course. Just make sure that you guys are reading that material because I did not add some stuff in there like team dynamics or resources for respiratory care or management of the post-cardiac arrest, you know, stuff like that. I didn't include that into this stuff. So if you guys need that or want that, then by all means, read the book or you know, Google it or whatever. But this right here is going to be the intro for the PALS stuff. So I hope you guys enjoy the Pediatric Advanced Life Support material for the course.
Patient's here. Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, there's never blood.
Well, he's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, or was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
She has 22 in her left hand.
For 45 minutes of CPR. No we can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive.
Great to be here.
If you are an ER nurse, maybe an ICU rock star, or really anyone who is bracing for that crucial PALS certification, today is for you.
Oh, absolutely.
We are focusing on the single most foundational skill you need to master. We're talking about shock.
Specifically, the pre-arrest state.
Right. How to recognize it in a pediatric patient before they just fall off that cliff into full cardiopulmonary failure.
That's the whole game. And, you know, we're not just going to be reciting the algorithm today.
No textbook reading here.
We're taking the PALS guidelines, specifically part 8, which focuses on shock recognition, and we are turning it into clinical reasoning.
The why.
Because pediatric codes, they rarely start with a primary heart problem.
Right. It's usually respiratory.
It's respiratory failure or, critically, it's shock that was missed that progresses and then becomes, you know, refractory to treatment.
And that progression, that is what we are here to stop. Our mission today is to move way beyond just memorizing signs and symptoms.
Yeah.
We want you to fundamentally understand the why behind those really subtle clinical cues.
Because for the ER nurse, your certification, it really depends on mastering this pre-arrest phase.
This is where you buy time.
And time is tissue. You have to catch that compensating child hours before the pressure drops.
So you're saying when shock is present, it's a race.
It is absolutely a race.
Mm-hmm.
Rapid identification and prompt intervention, and I mean within minutes, are critical to preventing that progression to cardiopulmonary failure and then, you know, subsequently cardiac arrest.
And the outcome is worse if you miss it.
Significantly worse. The trajectory of a child who codes because of inadequately treated shock is just so much worse than other causes. It's an accelerating process where, you know, cellular damage is just piling up with every single minute that goes by.
Okay, so let's unpack this with some real depth. We're going to dive into the core physiology.
The oxygen crisis at the cellular level.
Exactly. Then we'll get into how to accurately categorize the severity, that critical difference between compensated versus hypotensive shock.
The ticking clock.
And then the real challenge, right? The etiology and the rapid differentiation of the four main types of shock right there at the bedside.
Okay, so let's solidify our foundation. Let's start with the clinical definition.
What is shock?
At its core, shock is a physiologic state. It's characterized by inadequate tissue perfusion.
So, not enough blood flow to the tissues.
Not enough to meet their metabolic demand and their the need for oxygenation. It's a systemic failure. You're failing to deliver enough fuel to keep the engines running efficiently.
And this right here, this immediately tackles the biggest myth, doesn't it?
It does.
Especially for anyone who's maybe transitioning from adult pair, shock does not require hypotension.
I'm so glad you said that. That is the single most critical concept for any PLMS provider.
Say it again.
If you are waiting for the systolic blood pressure to cross that line into frank hypotension, you have already lost the battle.
Wow.
That child is no longer compensating. They're actively decompensating. Shock can be present, and often is, with normal or even initially increased systolic blood pressure.
How is that possible?
Because the body is just maximizing every single compensatory mechanism it has to keep that pressure up. It's a survival response.
So if blood pressure is a late indicator, our treatment goal has to be aimed at something more fundamental.
It has to be. The goal is to immediately improve systemic perfusion and oxygen delivery.
You're treating the cause, not the number on the monitor.
Exactly. We are racing to reverse end organ injury, which, by the way, is happening even in compensated shock, and to halt that inevitable progression towards circulatory collapse.
And this applies to all four types.
All four. You have hypovolemic, distributive, cardiogenic, and obstructive. They all lead to the exact same cellular crisis in the end, but they each require a totally distinct therapeutic approach.
Okay, so let's get into that deep dive on the cellular crisis, the fundamental pathophysiology. Why does inadequate oxygen delivery create such a rapid decline?
So think of the cell like a high-performance hybrid engine.
Okay.
Normally, when there's plenty of oxygen, a euro, the cell uses what we call aerobic metabolism.
Which is very efficient.
Incredibly efficient. It generates tons of energy, or ATP, with just water and co-euro as, you know, harmless byproducts.
But when the O delivery is insufficient, that's when things go wrong.
The cell is forced to switch to its backup generator. It's forced into anaerobic metabolism.
And that backup generator is not just inefficient, it's dirty. It creates a toxic byproduct.
Exactly. And that toxic byproduct is lactic acid.
The body's alarm bell.
That's a perfect way to put it. The accumulation, this rising lactic acid, creates a systemic acidosis, which profoundly impairs the function of all the key proteins and enzymes in the cell.
So it poisons everything.
It poisons everything. It affects the contractile proteins in the heart, the regulatory processes in the blood vessels. You get cell swelling, impaired function, organ dysfunction, and ultimately, you know, multi-organ failure.
And if you don't fix it,
if O delivery isn't restored, this self-perpetuating cycle guarantees cell death.
That really makes the urgency palpable. So let's break down the essential components. For adequate O delivery to happen, what three inputs have to align perfectly?
Okay, we can break it down pretty logically. First, you have to have sufficient O euros content in the blood.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, it's primarily determined by two things.
Right.
Your hemoglobin concentration, so how many transporters, how many little cars you have for the oxygen, and the percentage of that hemoglobin that's actually saturated with OEO, your sero.
So an anemic child could be in shock even if their circulation is fine.
Absolutely. Not enough cars on the road to deliver the goods.
Okay, so that's number one. What's the second input?
Second is adequate blood flow to the tissues.
Cardiac output.
That's your cardiac output. It's the engine of the entire system. We're going to drill way down into that next. But basically, if the pump is weak or the tank is empty, the flow just stops.
And then the third one, which really tends to define the difference between something like hypovolemic and, say, septic shock.
Right. And this is the one that's often overlooked. It's the appropriate distribution of that blood flow. The plumbing.
Yeah.
Distribution is regulated by your systemic vascular resistance, or SVR. Your tissues are constantly adjusting their own resistance to regulate flow based on what they need.
But in sepsis, that system goes haywire.
Completely haywire.
Yeah.
In a condition like severe sepsis, you get this massive inappropriate vasodilation. The pipes are just wide open everywhere. So blood flows really rapidly through these peripherally dilated capillary beds, but it doesn't distribute effectively to the vital organs.
So the blood pressure might hold for a minute.
For a minute, yeah. But the core tissues, the brain, the kidneys, they aren't receiving the oxygen they're desperately screaming for.
That brings us to a really fascinating concept that kind of crystallizes this whole supply and demand balance. Central venous O saturation, SCVRO.
Yes.
For the ER nurse who might not see this every day, help us understand why this number is like a diagnostic mirror.
It's a fantastic tool. What's so interesting here is that SCVRO is essentially a measurement of the O content in the blood that's returning to the right side of the heart from the body.
So it tells you how much oxygen the body didn't use.
Precisely. In a healthy state, tissues extract a normal percentage. Maybe they use about 25% or 30%, leaving about 65% to 75% saturation in the blood coming back.
So what happens when oligodendrocyte, the supply, is inadequate?
The tissues compensate. Or if metabolic demand is just extremely high, the tissues compensate by extracting more ORO.
So if that SCVO number drops low, say below 60%, it's like seeing the fuel gauge on empty.
That is a perfect analogy. A low SCVO tells you the tissues are starving.
They're wringing out every last drop of oxygen.
Every last molecule they can get their hands on. It's a huge signal that you have a major fall in cardiac output or maybe profound anemia. This is the classic finding in hypovolemic and most cardiogenic shocks.
But you mentioned a high SCVO can also be seen in shock, which seems counterintuitive. How can a patient be in shock if their venous blood is coming back rich with oxygen?
Right, and this is a key diagnostic nuance. You see this particularly in what we call warm septic shock. So in sepsis, two things can happen. First, that widespread peripheral vasodilation, that low SDR, can cause blood to flow so fast through the capillary beds, we call it shunting, that the tissues just don't have enough time to extract the ORO.
It's like a river moving too fast to fish in.
Exactly. And second, the toxins from sepsis can actually impair the ability of the cells themselves, the mitochondria, to use the oxygen that is delivered. It's a state we call cytopathic hypoxia.
So the oxygen is there, but the cell can't use it.
Correct. So in either case, the ORO returns to the heart unused, giving you this falsely reassuring or even high SCVO reading, even though the patient is in profound shock.
So we've established the crisis is ORO delivery failure. Now let's talk about the engine that drives that delivery, cardiac output.
Every single PLS algorithm really hinges on understanding this basic equation.
The basic math is absolutely non-negotiable. It's cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate.
CO equals FV times HR. Right. The total volume of blood pumped per minute is just the product of the volume pumped per beat and the number of beats per minute. Simple in theory.
But the complexity is in managing the components of stroke volume.
That's where it gets tricky.
Right. That one number, stroke volume, is determined by a trio of factors. And this trio is what dictates your entire treatment strategy in the trauma bay.
It is.
If you can figure out where the failure is in this trio, you know exactly what drug or what fluid to give.
Absolutely. And that trio, which we often call the determinants of stroke volume, are preload, contractility, and afterload.
Okay, let's define them with clinical relevance, not the textbook definition. Let's start with preload. Give us an analogy.
Preload is best visualized as the volume in the tank just before the pump fires.
How much fuel you have.
Exactly. It's the volume of blood that's present in the ventricle right before it contracts. Clinically, it reflects the patient's hydration and their circulating volume status.
So if a kid is bleeding or just profoundly dehydrated from gastroenteritis,
their preload is inadequate. The tank is empty, and we assess this clinically, you know, through signs of volume status like skin turgor, looking at their mucous membranes and seeing how they respond to a fluid challenge.
Okay, next up in the trio, contractility.
Contractility is simply the strength of the squeeze.
The power of the pump.
The power of the pump. It's the inherent ability of that cardiac muscle to contract and eject blood. When contractility is poor myocardial dysfunction, the pump fails, no matter how full the tank is.
And this is the hallmark of cardiogenic shock.
It is. We see it in cases like myocarditis or sometimes in late severe septic shock when the heart muscle itself is damaged.
And one for the afterload. This is the one that's often the most misunderstood.
It is. Afterload is the resistance the pump has to push against. Think of like the pressure in a hose nozzle.
Okay.
It's the resistance that the ventricle is ejecting blood against. High afterload, which is caused by intense vasoconstriction or high SVR, drastically increases the workload on the ventricle.
So if the heart is already compromised, that high afterload can be a killer.
It can be. It can severely impair stroke volume. And this is often the body's own compensation mechanism in hypovolemic or cardiogenic shock, but it can very quickly become detrimental.
Speaking of detrimental compensation, let's pivot to that critical concept that is so specific to pediatric physiology. Why are infants so incredibly vulnerable to changes in their heart rate?
This is the infant cardiac output dependency, and it is so important.
Well, you have to know this for PALS.
You have to.
Yeah.
In infants, the heart muscle fibers, they're structurally immature. They're less compliant than in adults. They have these very stiff, small ventricles.
So their stroke volume is tiny.
Tiny. And it has a very limited ability to increase, even when it needs to. Therefore, their only immediate effective tool for maintaining or increasing their cardiac output is by manipulating their heart rate.
So their main compensatory tool is also their biggest danger, isn't it?
It's a total double-edged sword, absolutely. If the rate is too slow, bradycardic output just plummets immediately.
Game over.
Pretty much. But the danger is often found in the extremes of tachycardia.
Too fast is just as bad as too slow.
Exactly. If the heart rate is excessive, say over 290 beats per minute in an infant with SVT, there's simply insufficient diastolic filling time.
The ventricles can't fill up.
They can't relax and fill adequately.
Mm-hmm.
This rapidly collapses their preload, which reduces their stroke volume and ultimately leads to cardiac output failure, mm-hmm. despite that super fast rate.
So the fast rate is actually causing the shock?
In that case, yes. And some arrhythmias, like complete heart block, are also dangerous because they interrupt what we call the atrial kick. That little extra squeeze from the atria contributes about 25% of the necessary ventricular filling. You lose that, and you've lost a quarter of your output right off the bat.
So the body knows it's in trouble, and it immediately launches this full-scale compensatory response. It's trying to maintain perfusion to the critical areas, right?
The brain and the heart.
The brain and the heart. And this compensation, it buys you time, but it also creates the subtle signs that you, the ER nurse, absolutely have to recognize.
Right. The body's immediate goal is profound, really. It's to sacrifice peripheral perfusion to maintain that central vital flow.
How does it do that?
It achieves this through four main actions, and they're all driven by the sympathetic nervous system and the release of catecholamines, you know, epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Okay, let's detail those actions. We already covered tachycardia. That's the primary response. What are the other three?
So second, the body initiates a massive increase in systemic vascular resistance, or SVR.
Clamping down.
Total peripheral vasoconstriction. It physically squeezes the blood vessels to raise the systemic pressure and shunt blood inward toward the core.
Okay, that's two.
Third, the catecholamines increase the strength of cardiac contraction, the contractility.
Squeeze harder.
Give the pump a little more oomph. And fourth, they increase venous smooth muscle tone.
What does that do?
It essentially tightens the capacity of the venous circulation, helping to push more blood back toward the heart, which improves preload.
This brings us right to compensated shock. This is the stage that separates the true PALS master from the novice.
It really is.
Because in compensated shock, these four mechanisms are successfully maintaining the systolic blood pressure in the normal range for that kid's age.
The BP is normal. That's the key.
So if the BP is normal, what are the key clinical signs we see because these compensatory mechanisms are working so hard?
You are seeing the consequences of the body trying to vasoconstrict its way out of disaster.
Shunting blood.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because SVR is maximized, blood is being shunted away from the periphery, away from the gut, and away from the kidneys.
Okay, let's focus on the periphery first. What does that look like?
In the periphery, this results in cold, pale, mottled, or diaphoretic, sweaty skin.
Okay.
And when you check the pulses, you're going to find weak or even absent peripheral pulses compared to the central pulses, like the femoral or the brachial.
Capillary refill.
Delayed, often 3 or more seconds.
Yeah.
And crucially, you're going to see a narrow pulse pressure.
Let's explain that again. Why is a narrow pulse pressure such a reliable early diagnostic indicator of trouble?
Okay, so pulse pressure is the difference between your systolic and your diastolic pressures.
Yeah.
So, you know, 120 over 80 gives you a 40 millimeter of mercury pulse pressure.
Right.
When the body maximizes SVR through vasoconstriction, it specifically raises the diastolic pressure.
Ah.
The systolic pressure is maintained for a bit longer because of contractility, but as that diastolic pressure rises up towards the systolic, the gap between them narrows.
So a pulse pressure of, say, less than 20?
A pulse pressure less than 20 or 25 millimeters of mercury in a compensating patient is a flashing red light. It is screaming at you. Maximum vasoconstriction is occurring.
Okay, so the body is shunting blood away from the kidneys and the gut. What functional consequences do we look for there?
Well, the kidneys are highly sensitive to poor perfusion. So you'll see oliguria, decreased urine output.
Check the diapers.
For any ER nurse, monitoring wet diapers or documented output is absolutely non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And in the gut, that increased splanchnic vascular resistance can lead to things like vomiting or even an ileus.
And finally, the most critical end organ, the brain.
Right. When cerebral autoregulation starts to fail, the child will start to demonstrate an altered mental status.
What does that look like in a kid?
It can be subtle. They might be restless, irritable, confused, or just overly lethargic. You have to integrate these subtle findings.
The whole picture.
The whole picture. A child who is tachycardic, clammy, has delayed cap refill, and it's just not acting right, even with a normal BP, is in compensated shock. And you were watching a life-saving intervention window just slam shut.
Now let's talk about that ominous transition. Hypotensive shock. Decompensated shock.
But the wheel's falling off.
This is the moment the wheels finally fall off.
Right. Hypotension means the compensatory mechanisms, that high SVR and the increased contractility, have failed. SVR can no longer compensate for the falling cardiac output.
And the pressure drops.
The blood pressure begins to decline. And that signifies severely impaired perfusion that will rapidly progress to cardiac arrest. At this point, O delivery to the myocardium, to the heart muscle itself, becomes inadequate.
Which creates a vicious cycle.
A terrible one. You get myocardial dysfunction, which further reduces stroke volume, which leads to irreversible end organ injury. It's a death spiral.
The time differential you highlighted earlier is genuinely terrifying. It really dictates our urgency.
It's the high-faced reality of pediatric care.
Mm.
Compensated shock can last for hours. That is your golden window.
But once you're hypotensive.
But once that child crosses into hypotensive shock, the literature shows they have potentially minutes until cardiopulmonary failure and arrest.
Minutes.
Minutes. So when you identify that systolic pressure dropping below the acceptable level, and you have to remember the formula for kids 1 to 10 years old.
SBP less than 70 plus 2 times the age in years.
Right. When you see that, the pace of your intervention has to accelerate tenfold. AMCRO. Okay, so moving into differentiations where the rubber really meets the road.
This is key.
Understanding the differences in preload, contractility, and afterload for each of the 4 types of shock is essential. It's your cognitive roadmap for treatment.
Because giving fluids to a kid with hypovolemic shock is life-saving.
And giving the same amount of fluid to a kid with cardiogenic shock can be fatal.
Let's start with the most common type we see in pediatrics, the one that accounts for the vast majority of presentations.
Hypovolemic shock.
Problem, volume deficit.
The etiology is a simple issue of volume loss or a fluid shift. In the ER, this is most commonly severe gastroenteritis, vomiting, and diarrhea.
The stomach bug.
The stomach bug. Or severe dehydration, hemorrhage from trauma, large burns, or something like DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis, for that massive osmotic diuresis.
Physiologically, what's the simple breakdown of the 3 factors? Preload, afterload, contractility.
It's low, high, normal to increased.
Low preload.
The tank is empty. There is a decreased preload. The body compensates aggressively by maximally increasing afterload, so high SVR.
And contractility.
Contractility is usually normal or even increased initially because of that catecholamine release trying to maintain output.
And clinically, this gives you that classic cold shock profile.
Yes. Tachycardia, a normal to low BP with that characteristic narrow pulse pressure from the high SVR.
Weak pulses.
Weak or absent peripheral pulses, cool, clammy extremities, delayed cap refill, and oliguria. If the history points to fluid loss, and the exam shows cold, clammy vasoconstriction, your first line of treatment is rapid volume replacement.
Okay, next. Let's tackle the second major category. Distributive shock problem. Misdistribution or vasodilation.
Right. The volume is often there, but it's sitting in the wrong place, or it's leaking out of the pipes.
So what's happening?
This is characterized by a loss of vasomotor tone. The vessels are just wide open. This causes a severely reduced SVR and results in what we call relative hypovolemia.
Relative hypovolemia.
Yeah, the blood is pooling peripherally, or the capillary leak is causing fluid to third space out into the interstitium. The main causes are sepsis, anaphylaxis, and neurogenic shock.
The physiology matrix here is more complex, isn't it? It's more variable.
It is. It's variable, variable, and normal to decreased.
Okay, break that down.
Preload is functionally decreased because of that venous pooling and the capillary leak. Afterload is typically severely low, especially early on, because of the massive vasodilation.
And contractility.
Can be normal or it can be depressed, especially as sepsis progresses and those toxins start to damage the myocardium directly.
Okay, let's focus on the most common and challenging presentation of distributive shock, septic shock.
Sepsis triggers a systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS. You get this flood of cytokines into the system.
An inflammatory storm.
A total storm. It causes vasodilation, increased capillary permeability, which leads to significant plasma leak, and often direct myocardial dysfunction. The key clinical challenge with sepsis is that it's a chameleon.
Tell us about the warm shock versus cold shock presentation.
So early hyperdynamic or warm shock is classic for sepsis, especially in older children.
What does that look like?
SVR is profoundly low, which results in warm, flushed extremities and bounding peripheral pulses.
And the pulse pressure.
A wide pulse pressure, because that massive vasodilation causes the diastolic pressure to just plummet. This is the body's inability to squeeze the hose.
But it can also present as cold shock.
It can. If the shock progresses, or if the patient has profound myocardial dysfunction, they can enter cold shock.
What happens then?
Peripheral vasoconstriction is maximized in compensation, which leads to cool extremities, weak pulses, and a narrow pulse pressure.
Which makes it look just like hypovolemic or cardiogenic shock.
Exactly. It becomes clinically indistinguishable without a history of infection.
And the ultimate clinical pearl for septic shock. What should we always be thinking about?
Always consider adrenal insufficiency.
Why is that?
It's often overlooked. Severe stress can lead to a functional adrenal insufficiency, where the body just can't produce enough endogenous cortisol.
And why is cortisol so important?
Cortisol is essential for maintaining vascular tone and myocardial responsiveness to catecholamines. Without it, SVR stays low, myocardial function drops, and it really complicates your management. It's why we sometimes need to give steroids alongside fluids and pressors.
Okay, moving quickly to another distributive issue, anaphylactic shock.
Right, an acute hypersensitivity reaction. You get this massive mast cell degranulation and histamine release.
And the outcome is basically the same as sepsis.
Widespread vasodilation and increased capillary permeability. Physiologically, a decreased preload and a severely decreased afterload are the dominant features.
The respiratory and skin signs here make the differentiation pretty rapid, though.
Oh, absolutely. You'll see the classic signs of airway involvement, angioedema, stridor, wheezing alongside hypotension, tachycardia, and that generalized urticaria or hives and itching.
Well, the treatment is immediate.
Immediate airway management and intramuscular epinephrine. It reverses the vasodilation and bronchodilates at the same time.
Okay, finally, within distributive shock, the unique presentation of neurogenic shock.
This is typically due to a high spinal cord injury, a cervical or high thoracic injury.
What does the injury do?
It disrupts the sympathetic nervous system pathways. This results in unopposed parasympathetic tone and uncontrolled vasodilation below the level of the injury.
So the physiology.
Severely decreased preload and severely decreased afterload.
But the critical differentiating sign, the thing that should immediately raise suspicion, is the heart rate paradox.
This is the exception to the rule. Unlike virtually every other form of shock, where the body tries to compensate with tachycardia
and neurogenic shock,
it often presents with a normal heart rate or even bradycardia, despite profound hypotension.
Why?
Because those sympathetic compensatory pathways that originate higher ups are interrupted. The heart simply cannot get the signal to speed up. The treatment here needs careful volume management, but it often relies heavily on central vasoconstrictors, on pressors, to replace that lost vasomotor tone.
Okay, let's pivot hard now to cardiogenic shock, the problem. Pump failure. This is the one where fluid resuscitation can kill your patient.
Absolutely. The etiology here includes things like myocarditis, severe congenital heart disease like a cardiomyopathy, persistent arrhythmias, or even severe septic shock that has transitioned into profound myocardial injury.
The definition is?
Heart failure causing inadequate systemic perfusion. The pump is broken.
So if the pump itself fails, what happens to our physiology matrix?
It's low, high, high.
Low contractility.
Contractility is profoundly decreased.
Yeah.
And because the weak heart can't eject blood forward, fluid backs up into the circulation.
Leading to?
Significantly increased filling pressures. So increased preload. The pipes are backing up.
Oh, an afterload.
In response, the body attempts to save the blood pressure by maximizing afterload. It clamps down hard, so you have a high SVR.
And this compensation is profoundly detrimental. It's a vicious cycle.
It is a toxic positive feedback loop. That increased afterload means the already failing heart has to push against extreme resistance. This further increases the myocardial oxygen demand and workload, which just exacerbates the pump failure.
It's a downward spiral.
A very rapid one. And that's why early treatment with inotropes and afterload reduction is so critical.
What are the unique clinical signs that just scream cardiogenic?
You're looking for the signs of venous congestion and fluid overload.
In the lungs.
You'll see labored breathing with retractions, nasal flaring, and often crackles or rails on auscultation. You'll hear frank pulmonary edema from fluid backing up into the lungs.
And systemically.
Look for signs of right-sided failure. Hepatomegaly. An enlarged liver from systemic venous pooling and if you can see a jugular venous distension, or JVD.
And the perfusion signs.
The child will have weak pulses and cool extremities, and importantly, that narrow pulse pressure again because of the compensatory high SVR.
This leads us to the critical warning. For the ER nurse, aggressive fluid administration is the number one mistake to avoid here.
In cardiogenic shock, you must be surgical with your fluid. Rapid volume resuscitation, so fluid boluses greater than 10 millimoles per kilo G, is often contraindicated because you are massively increasing the already high preload on a critically failing pump. This immediately exacerbates the pulmonary edema, severely impairs oxygenation, and will often precipitate a full respiratory and cardiac arrest.
So if you suspect cardiogenic shock,
fluid should be limited. We often give it only in tiny aliquots, maybe 5 millimole per kilogram over 10 to 20 minutes, while you are continuously monitoring for any sign of worsening respiratory distress.
Okay, our final category, obstructive shock, the problem, a physical block.
Right, this is a mechanical impairment. It's limiting either venous return to the heart or it's obstructing the outflow from the heart. The causes are immediate life threats.
Such as?
Cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, a massive pulmonary embolism, which is rare in children but devastating, and certain ductal-dependent lesions in neonates.
What's the common physiological threat here?
Obstruction. Preload is often critically low because the heart can't fill effectively. Contractility is usually normal, but the obstruction prevents the pump from working efficiently.
And afterload?
Is increased due to that compensatory SVR. The core issue is simply a physical block of the circulation.
Let's detail cardiac tamponade.
Tamponade is caused by an accumulation of fluid or blood or even air in that non-compliant pericardial space around the heart.
So it's squeezing the heart from the outside.
Exactly. This increases the external pressure, compressing the ventricles and preventing adequate filling. Stroke volume plummets, CO fails, and untreated, it rapidly progresses to cardiac arrest, classically presenting as pulseless electrical activity, or PEA.
We have to know the classic signs.
We look for the adapted Beck's triad. So you have hypotension, muffled or diminished heart sounds because the fluid is buffering the sounds, and distended neck veins, or JVD, though that's tough to see in infants.
Is there a more definitive sign?
The definitive sign, if the patient is breathing spontaneously, is pulsus paradoxus.
An exaggerated drop in systolic blood pressure during inspiration.
Right, a drop of more than 10 millimeters of mercury.
Why does that happen?
Okay, so during inspiration, you create negative intrathoracic pressure, which normally draws more blood into the right side of the heart.
Right.
But in tamponade, that non-compliant pericardium prevents the right ventricle from expanding to accommodate that extra blood. Instead, the increased right-sided volume physically pushes the ventricular septum over into the left ventricle.
Restricting its filling.
Severely. It collapses the left-sided stroke volume, and that results in a measurable drop in blood pressure.
Next, tension pneumothorax.
This is a surgical emergency. Air accumulates in the pleural space, often from trauma or barotrauma, from positive pressure ventilation.
And that pressure causes?
A massive pressure shift that compresses the lung on that side, displaces the heart and the mediastinum, and it kinks the great veins, effectively stopping venous return to the heart.
The differentiating signs.
Brachial deviation away from the affected side, which is a very late pre-arrest sign.
What else?
Profoundly diminished or absent breath, sounds on the affected side, hyperresonance to percussion, and a rapid progression toward bradycardia. The intervention here is immediate.
Needle decompression.
Needle decompression or chest tube placement. The block has to be relieved physically right now.
And finally, the neonate-specific obstructive shock. Ductal-dependent lesions.
Right. These are congenital defects where either the pulmonary or the systemic blood flow relied entirely on the patent ductus arteriosus staying open.
Like a coarctation of the aorta.
Exactly, like a severe coarctation. When that ductus naturally begins to close in the first hours or days of life, flow is immediately obstructed and signs of shock appear with terrifying speed.
What's the quick assessment hint for that in the nursery?
You're looking for signs of congestive heart failure and profound metabolic acidosis. A key differentiator is a significant variation in oxygen saturation or perfusion between the productal site, so the right arm, and a postductal site, like a lower extremity.
What kind of difference?
Any difference greater than 3 or 4% is a massive red flag. And the immediate life-saving intervention is giving prostaglandin E1 to medically keep that ductus arteriosus open.
Okay, we've covered the four unique physiological profiles. Now, how do we operationalize this at the bedside?
Right.
You're in the trauma bay, things are chaotic, you need rapid answers to the question, what type of shock is this?
you have to rely on something like the shock recognition flowchart. It translates this complex physiology into observable clinical findings.
We have to learn to group them.
You have to group them and process them simultaneously.
Let's start by contrasting the respiratory effort first, because that seems like the quickest way to differentiate the fluid-sensitive shock.
It is. In hypovolemic and often in distributive shock, the child will likely be tachypneic.
Breathing fast.
Breathing fast to blow off that lactic acid. It's a metabolic compensation. But the effort itself is usually quiet or normal.
In contrast,
cardiogenic and obstructive shock present with labored breathing. You see retractions, nasal flaring, grunting, you hear crackles.
Why?
Because of fluid backing up into the lungs in cardiogenic shock, or that mechanical compression in obstructive shock.
Right.
If the child is working hard to breathe and has crackles, you immediately shift away from aggressive fluid resuscitation.
Okay, next, let's revisit the skin and the pulse quality. Let's contrast those three cold shocks we talked about.
Right. So if the child is cold, clammy, and has delayed cap refill, that tells you they have a high SVR.
They're clamped down.
So you're in the world of hypovolemic, cardiogenic, or obstructive shock. They all present very similarly on the outside.
So how do you tell them apart?
The differentiation relies entirely on the other clues.
Yeah.
Is there evidence of fluid congestion, like JBD, hepatomegaly, crackles? That's cardiogenic.
Okay.
Is there a history of fluid loss or trauma? That's hypovolemic. Or are there signs of physical compression, like muffled heart sounds or unilateral decreased breath sounds?
Sure.
That points you to obstructive.
And the exception to the cold rule, distributive shock.
Yes. Remember that warm distributive septic shock is the exception. If the child is warm, fleshed, has bounding peripheral pulses, and that wide pulse pressure with a low diastolic,
you're almost certainly dealing with severe vasodilation.
Right, which demands volume and often pressors immediately. That narrow pulse pressure is your sign of maximum compensation. The wide pulse pressure is your sign of maximum failure of vascular tone.
This all boils down to clinical translation. The principle of identify and intervene, they have to be simultaneous.
Absolutely. The PALS provider cannot wait for definitive labs. Airway, breathing, and circulation support must start immediately while you are investigating the underlying cause.
Get the ABCs going.
Secure the airway, gain immediate IV or IO access, and start supporting circulation. Those are the priorities.
Can you reiterate the most dangerous clinical confusion, the trauma pitfall we should all be aware of?
It is mistaking early cardiogenic shock for hypovolemic shock.
Happens all the time.
It does. If the child has a history suggesting dehydration and they're cold and tachycardic, the reflex is to just slam them with a large fluid bolus.
Right.
But if that child actually has an underlying myocarditis, that fluid bolus will flood their lungs and precipitate an arrest.
So what's the warning sign?
If you see any signs of fluid overload labored breathing, new crackles on exam, increasing irritability after you give fluid, you must halt aggressive fluid and pivot immediately to inotropic support and diuretic management.
And for the obstructive shocks, the immediate focus isn't pharmacology, is it?
Correct. For obstructive shock, while you are supporting the patient, your primary mission is to relieve the block.
The physical problem needs a physical solution.
Exactly. Needle decompression for attention pneumo has to happen now. Preparing for a pericardiocentesis for tamponade has to happen now. The goal is to relieve the physical block that is impeding flow. That's often the most critical task for the PALS provider in those scenarios.
Okay, so let's bring it all home. As the ER nurse listening to this, what is the single most important, subtle finding you need to train your eye to see when you're reviewing the signs of compensated shock?
It's the combination of the heart rate and the capillary refill time.
Why those two?
Because the heart rate is up, which is signaling distress, and the cap refill is delayed, which is signaling peripheral shunting. That combination tachycardia plus poor perfusion signs tells you the compensatory mechanisms are maxed out and the clock is ticking toward decompensation.
And that's the moment.
That is the moment, hours before the blood pressure drops, where your intervention is most likely to be life-saving. You have to trust your assessment over the monitor's reassuring BP reading.
So we have taken a really comprehensive deep dive into the world of pediatric shock recognition.
We covered a lot of ground.
We did. We established that shock is inadequate perfusion, not necessarily hypotension. We covered that compensated shock is subtle, but that's your critical window.
And that hypotension is the late ominous finding that precedes a minutes to arrest situation.
Right. And most importantly, we learned that knowing the physiological status, is it low preload, depressed contractility, or abnormal afterload? That predicts whether you need fluid, pressors, or a physical intervention to save that child's life.
And as you move forward in your Pellis preparation, I want to leave you with one final thought. It's a kind of high-level diagnostic shortcut for the most intense situations.
Okay.
We talked a lot about how a narrow pulse pressure signifies high SVR and maximum compensatory effort. It points you toward those cold shocks, hypovolemic, cardiogenic, or obstructive.
Right.
Conversely, a wide pulse pressure signifies low SVR and a failure of vascular tone. It points you toward warm distributive shock.
So use that number.
Use that physical difference, which you can calculate instantly from the monitor, to fundamentally guide your immediate fluid and pressor decisions right there at the bedside.
Master this recognition phase. Apply this foundational understanding of physiology, and you are going to be ready to approach the intervention algorithms with real confidence. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.